This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society by Mary Ann Schaefer and Annie Barrows. Read for you by Paul Bamer, Susan Duerden, Rosalind Landor, John Lee, and Juliet Mills. Part 1. 8th of January, 1946. Mr. Sidney Stark, publisher, Stevens & Stark Limited, 21 St. James's Place, London, SW1, England. Dear Sidney, Susan Scott is a wonder. We sold over 40 copies of the book, which was very pleasant, but much more thrilling from my standpoint was the food. Susan managed to procure ration coupons for icing sugar and real eggs for the meringue. If all her literary luncheons are going to achieve these heights, I won't mind touring about the country. Do you suppose that a lavish bonus could spur her on to butter? Let's try it. You may deduct the money from my royalties. Now for my grim news. You asked me how work on my new book is progressing. Sydney, it isn't. English foibles seemed so promising at first. After all, one should be able to write reams about the Society to Protest the Glorification of the English Bunny. I unearthed a photograph of the Vermin Exterminators Trade Union marching down an Oxford street, with placards screaming, "Down with Beatrix Potter!" But what is there to write about after a caption? Nothing, that's what. I no longer want to write this book. My head and my heart just aren't in it. Dear as Izzy Bickerstaff is, and was, to me, I don't want to write anything else under that name. I don't want to be considered a light-hearted journalist anymore. I do acknowledge that making readers laugh, or at least chuckle, during the war was no mean feat. But I don't want to do it anymore. I can't seem to dredge up any sense of proportion or balance these days, and God knows one cannot write humour without them. In the meantime, I am very happy Stevens and Stark is making money on Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War. It relieves my conscience over the debacle of my Anne Bronte biography. My thanks for everything and love, Juliet. P.S. I am reading the collected correspondence of Mrs. Montague. Do you know what that dismal woman wrote to Jane Carlyle? "My dear little Jane, everybody is born with a vocation, and yours is to write charming little notes. I hope Jane spat on her."
From Sydney to Juliet. 10th of January, 1946. Miss Juliet Ashton, 23, Glebe Place, Chelsea, London, SW3. Dear Juliet, congratulations! Susan Scott said you took to the audience at the luncheon like a drunkard to rum, and they to you. So please stop worrying about your tour next week. I haven't a doubt of your success. Having witnessed your electrifying performance of The Shepherd Boy Sings in the Valley of Humiliation 18 years ago, I know you will have every listener coiled around your little finger within moments. A hint? Perhaps in this case you should refrain from throwing the book at the audience when you finish. Susan is looking forward to ushering you through bookshops from Bath to Yorkshire, and of course, Sophie is agitating for an extension of the tour into Scotland. I've told her in my most infuriating older brother manner that it remains to be seen. She misses you terribly, I know, but Stevens and Stark must be impervious to such considerations. I've just received Izzy's sales figures from London and the home counties. They are excellent. Again, congratulations. Don't fret about English foibles. Better that your enthusiasm died now than after 6 months spent writing about bunnies. The crass commercial possibilities of the idea were attractive, but I agree that the topic would soon grow horribly fey. Another subject, one you'll like, will occur to you. Dinner one evening before you go? Say when. Love, Sydney. P.S. You write charming little notes.
From Juliet to Sydney. 11th of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, yes, lovely. Can it be somewhere on the river? I want oysters and champagne and roast beef, if obtainable. If not, a chicken will do. I am very happy that Izzy's sails are good. Are they good enough that I don't have to pack a bag and leave London? Since you and S&S have turned me into a moderately successful author, dinner must be my treat. Love, Juliet. P.S. I did not throw the Shepherd Boy Sings in the Valley of Humiliation at the audience. I threw it at the elocution mistress. I meant to cast it at her feet, but I missed. From Juliet to Sophie Strachan, 12th of January, 1946. Mrs. Alexander Strachan, Feoken Farm, by Oban, Argyll. Dear Sophie, of course I'd adore to see you, but I am a soulless, willless automaton. I have been ordered by Sydney to Bath, Colchester, Leeds, and several other garden spots I can't recall at the moment, and I can't just slither off to Scotland instead. Sydney's brow would lower, his eyes would narrow, he would stalk. You know how nerve-wracking it is when Sydney stalks. I wish I could sneak away to your farm and have you coddle me. You'd let me put my feet on the sofa, wouldn't you? And then you'd tuck blankets around me and bring me tea. Would Alexander mind a permanent resident on his sofa? You've told me he is a patient man, but perhaps he would find it annoying. Why am I so melancholy? I should be delighted at the prospect of reading Izzy to an entranced audience. You know how I love talking about books, and you know how I adore receiving compliments. I should be thrilled. But the truth is that I'm gloomy, gloomier than I ever was during the war. Everything is so broken, Sophie. The roads, the buildings, the people, especially the people. This is probably the after-effect of a horrid dinner party I went to last night. The food was ghastly, but that was to be expected. It was the guests who unnerved me. They were the most demoralizing collection of individuals I've ever encountered. The talk was of bombs and starvation. Do you remember Sarah Moorcroft? She was there, all bones and goose flesh and bloody lipstick. Didn't she used to be pretty? Wasn't she mad for that horse-riding fellow who went up to Cambridge? He was nowhere in evidence. She's married to a doctor with grey skin who clicks his tongue before he speaks. And he was a figure of wild romance compared to my dinner partner, who just happened to be a single man, presumably the last one on earth. Oh, Lord, how miserably mean-spirited I sound. I swear, Sophie, I think there's something wrong with me. Every man I meet is intolerable. Perhaps I should set my sights lower. Not so low as the grey doctor who clicks, but a bit lower. I can't even blame it on the war. I was never very good at men, was I? Do you suppose the St. Swithin's furnace man was my one true love? Since I never spoke to him, it seems unlikely. But at least it was a passion unscathed by disappointment. And he had that beautiful black hair. After that, you remember, came the year of poets. Sydney's quite snarky about those poets, though I don't see why, since he introduced me to them. Then poor Adrian. No, there's no need to recite the dread roles to you. Sophie, what is the matter with me? Am I too particular? I don't want to be married just to be married. I can't think of anything lonelier than spending the rest of my life with someone I can't talk to, or worse, someone I can't be silent with. What a dreadful, complaining letter. You see, I've succeeded in making you feel relieved that I won't be stopping in Scotland. But then again, I may. My fate rests with Sydney. Kiss Dominic for me, and tell him I saw a rat the size of a terrier the other day. Love to Alexander, and even more to you, Juliet.
From Darcy Adams, Guernsey, Channel Islands, to Juliet, 12th of January, 1946. Miss Juliet Ashton, 81 Oakley Street, Chelsea, London SW3. Dear Miss Ashton, my name is Darcy Adams, and I live on my farm in St. Martin's Parish on Guernsey. I know of you because I have an old book that once belonged to you, The Selected Essays of Elia, by an author whose name in real life was Charles Lamb. Your name and address were written inside the front cover. I will speak plain. I love Charles Lamb. My own book says Selected, so I wondered if that meant he had written other things to choose from. These are the pieces I want to read, and though the Germans are gone now, there aren't any bookshops left on Guernsey. I want to ask a kindness of you. Could you send me the name and address of a bookshop in London? I would like to order more of Charles Lamb's writings by post. I would also like to ask if anyone has ever written his life story, and if they have, could a copy be found for me? For all his bright and turning mind, I think Mr. Lamb must have had a great sadness in his life. Charles Lamb made me laugh during the German occupation, especially when he wrote about the roast pig. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society came into being because of a roast pig we had to keep secret from the German soldiers, so I feel a kinship to Mr. Lamb. I am sorry to bother you, but I would be sorrier still not to know about him, as his writings have made me his friend. Hoping not to trouble you, Darcy Adams. P.S. My friend Mrs. Margery bought a pamphlet that once belonged to you, too. It is called Was There a Burning Bush? A Defense of Moses and the Ten Commandments. She liked your margin note. Word of God or crowd control? Did you ever decide which?
From Juliet to Darcy, 15th of January, 1946. Mr. Darcy Adams, Les Voulurons, La Bouvée, St. Martin's, Guernsey. Dear Mr. Adams, I no longer live on Oakley Street, but I am so glad that your letter found me and that my book found you. It was a sad wrench to part with The Selected Essays of Elia. I had two copies and a dire need of shelf room, but I felt like a traitor selling it. You have soothed my conscience. I wonder how the book got to Guernsey. Perhaps there is some secret sort of homing instinct in books that brings them to their perfect readers. How delightful if that were true. Because there is nothing I would rather do than rummage through bookshops, I went at once to Hastings and Sons upon receiving your letter. I have gone to them for years, always finding the one book I wanted, and then three more I hadn't known I wanted. I told Mr. Hastings you would like a good clean copy, and not a rare edition, of More Essays of Elia. He will send it to you by separate post, invoice enclosed, and was delighted to know you are also a lover of Charles Lamb. He said the best biography of Lamb was by E. V. Lucas, and he would hunt out a copy for you, though it may take a while. In the meantime, will you accept this small gift from me? It is his selected letters. I think it will tell you more about him than any biography ever could. E. V. Lucas sounds too stately to include my favourite passage from Lamb. Buzz, 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 bum, 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 wheeze, 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 fen, 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 tinky, 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 cranch. I shall certainly come to be condemned at last. I have been drinking too much for 2 days running. I find my moral sense in the last stage of a consumption and my religion getting faint. You'll find that in the letters. It's on page 244. They were the first Lamb I ever read, and I'm ashamed to say I only bought the book because I'd read elsewhere that a man named Lamb had visited his friend Lee Hunt in prison for libelling the Prince of Wales. While there, Lamb helped Hunt paint the ceiling of his cell sky blue with white clouds. Next, they painted a rose trellis up one wall. Then, I further discovered, Lamb offered money to help Hunt's family outside the prison, though he himself was as poor as a man could be. Lamb also taught Hunt's youngest daughter to say the Lord's Prayer backward. You naturally want to learn everything you can about a man like that. That's what I love about reading. One tiny thing will interest you in a book, and that tiny thing will lead you onto another book, and another bit there will lead you onto a third book. It's geometrically progressive, all with no end in sight, and for no other reason than sheer enjoyment. The red stain on the cover that looks like blood is blood. I got careless with my paper knife. The enclosed postcard is a reproduction of a painting of Lamb by his friend William Hazlitt. If you have time to correspond with me, could you answer several questions? Three, in fact. Why did a roast pig dinner have to be kept a secret? How could a pig cause you to begin a literary society? And, most pressing of all, what is a potato peel pie? And why is it included in your society's name? I have sublet a flat at 23 Glebe Place, Chelsea, London, SW3. My Oakley Street flat was bombed in 1945, and I still miss it. Oakley Street was wonderful. I could see the Thames out of three of my windows. I know that I'm fortunate to have any place at all to live in London, but I much prefer whining to counting my blessings. I am glad you thought of me to do your Elia hunting. Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton. P.S. I never could make up my mind about Moses. It still bothers me. From Juliet to Sydney, 18th of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, this isn't a letter, it's an apology. Please forgive my moaning about the teas and luncheons you set up for Izzy. Did I call you a tyrant? I take it all back. I love Stevens and Stark for sending me out of London. Bath is a glorious town. Lovely crescents of white, upstanding houses instead of London's black, gloomy buildings, or, worse still, piles of rubble that were once buildings. It is bliss to breathe in clean, fresh air with no coal smoke and no dust. The weather is cold, but it isn't London's dank chill. Even the people on the street look different. Upstanding, like their houses, not grey and hunched like Londoners. Susan said the guests at Abbott's Book Tea enjoyed themselves immensely, and I know I did. I was able to unstick my tongue from the roof of my mouth after the first 2 minutes, and began to have quite a good time. Susan and I are off tomorrow for bookshops in Colchester, Norwich, King's Lynn, Bradford, and Leeds. Love and thanks, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 21st of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, night-time train travel is wonderful again. No standing in the corridors for hours, no being shunted off for a troop train to pass, and above all, no blackout curtains. All the windows we passed were lighted, and I could snoop once more. I missed it so terribly during the war. I felt as if we had all turned into moles, scuttling along in our separate tunnels. I don't consider myself a real peeper. They go in for bedrooms, but it's families in sitting rooms or kitchens that thrill me. I can imagine their entire lives from a glimpse of bookshelves or desks or lit candles or bright sofa cushions. There was a nasty, condescending man in Tillman's bookshop today. After my talk about Izzy, I asked if anyone had questions. He literally leapt from his seat to go nose to nose with me. How was it, he demanded, that I, a mere woman, dared to bastardize the name of Isaac Bickerstaff? The true Isaac Bickerstaff, noted journalist, nay, the sacred heart and soul of 18th century literature, dead now, and his name desecrated by you. Before I could muster a word, a woman in the back row jumped to her feet. Oh, sit down. You can't desecrate a person who never was. He's not dead because he was never alive. Isaac Bickerstaff was a pseudonym for Joseph Addison's Spectator columns. Miss Ashton can take up any pretend name she wants to, so shut up. What a valiant defender. He left the store in a hurry. Sydney, do you know a man named Markham V. Reynolds, Jr.? If you don't, will you look him up for me? Who's Who? The Doomsday Book? Scotland Yard? Failing those, he may simply be in the telephone directory. He sent a beautiful bunch of mixed spring flowers to me at the hotel in Bath. A dozen white roses to my train, and a pile of red roses to Norwich. All with no message, only his engraved card. Come to that. How does he know where Susan and I are staying? What trains we are taking? All his flowers have met me upon my arrival. I don't know whether to feel flattered or hunted. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 23rd of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, Susan just gave me the sales figures for Izzy. I can scarcely believe them. I honestly thought everyone would be so weary of the war that no one would want a remembrance of it, and certainly not in a book. Happily, and once again, you were right and I was wrong. It half kills me to admit this. Travelling, talking before a captive audience, signing books, and meeting strangers is exhilarating. The women I've met have told me such war stories of their own, I almost wish I had my column back. Yesterday, I had a lovely gossipy chat with a Norwich lady. She has four daughters in their teens, and just last week, the eldest was invited to tea at the cadet school in town. Arrayed in her finest frock and spotless white gloves, the girl made her way to the school, stepped over the threshold, took one look at the sea of shining cadet faces before her, and fainted dead away. The poor child had never seen so many males in one place in her life. Think of it. A whole generation grown up without dances or teas or flirting. I love seeing the bookshops and meeting the booksellers. Booksellers really are a special breed. No one in their right mind would take up clerking in a bookstore for the salary, and no one in his right mind would want to own one. The margin of profit is too small. So it has to be a love of readers and reading that makes them do it, along with first dibs on the new books. Do you remember the first job your sister and I had in London? In crabby Mr. Hawke's second-hand bookshop. How I loved him. He'd simply unpack a box of books, hand one or two to us and say, "No cigarette ashes, clean hands, and for God's sake, Juliet, none of your margin notes. Sophie, dear, don't let her drink coffee while she reads." And off we'd go with new books to read. It was amazing to me then, and still is, that so many people who wander into bookshops don't really know what they're after. They only want to look around and hope to see a book that will strike their fancy. And then, being bright enough not to trust the publisher's blurb, they will ask the book clerk the three questions. 1. What is it about? 2. Have you read it? 3. Was it any good? Real dyed-in-the-wool booksellers, like Sophie and me, can't lie. Our faces are always a dead giveaway. A lifted brow or curled lip reveals that it is a poor excuse for a book. And the clever customers ask for a recommendation instead, whereupon we frog-march them over to a particular volume and command them to read it. If they read it and despise it, they'll never come back. But if they like it, they're customers for life. Are you taking notes? You should. A publisher should send not just one reader's copy to a bookshop, but several, so that all the staff can read it too. Mr. Seton told me today that Izzy Bickerstaff makes an ideal present for both someone you like and someone you don't like, but have to give a present to anyway. He also claimed that 30% of all books bought are bought as gifts. 30%! Did he lie? Has Susan told you what else she has managed besides our tour? Me. I hadn't known her half an hour before she told me my makeup, my clothes, my hair, and my shoes were drab. All drab. The war was over, hadn't I heard? She took me to Madame Helena's for a haircut. It is now short and curly instead of long and lank. I had a light rinse, too. Susan and Madame said it would bring out the golden highlights in my beautiful chestnut curls. But I know better. It's meant to cover any grey hairs, 4 by my count, that have begun to creep in. I also bought a jar of face cream a lovely scented hand lotion, a new lipstick, and an eyelash curler, which makes my eyes cross whenever I use it. Then Susan suggested a new dress. I reminded her that the Queen was very happy wearing her 1939 wardrobe, so why shouldn't I be? She said the Queen doesn't need to impress strangers, but I do. I felt like a traitor to crown and country. No decent woman has new clothes. But I forgot that the moment I saw myself in the mirror. My first new dress in 4 years. And such a dress. It is the exact colour of a ripe peach and falls in lovely folds when I move. The sales lady said it had Gallic chic, and I would too if I bought it. So I did. New shoes are going to have to wait, since I spent almost a year's worth of clothing coupons on the dress. Between Susan, my hair, my face, and my dress, I no longer look a listless, bedraggled 32-year-old. I look a lively, dashing, haute-coutured, if this isn't a French verb, it should be, 30. Apropos of my new dress and no new shoes, doesn't it seem shocking to have more stringent rationing after the war than during the war? I realise that hundreds of thousands of people all over Europe must be fed, housed and clothed. But privately, I resent it that so many of them are Germans. I am still without any ideas for a book I want to write. It is beginning to depress me. Do you have any suggestions? Since I am in what I consider to be the North, I'm going to place a trunk call to Sophie in Scotland tonight. Any messages for your sister, your brother-in-law, your nephew? This is the longest letter I've ever written. You needn't reply in kind. Love, Juliet.
From Susan Scott to Sydney. 25th of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, don't believe the newspaper reports. Juliet was not arrested and taken away in handcuffs. She was merely reproved by one of Bradford's constables, and he could barely keep a straight face. She did throw a teapot at Gilly Gilbert's head, but don't believe his claim that she scalded him. The tea was cold. Besides, it was more of a skim-by than a direct hit. Even the hotel manager refused to let us compensate him for the teapot. It was only dented. He was, however, forced by Gilly's screams to call in the constabulary. Herewith the story, and I take full responsibility for it. I should have refused Gilly's request for an interview with Juliet. I knew what a loathsome person he was, one of those unctuous little worms who work for the London Hue and Cry. I also knew that Gilly and the LH&C were horribly jealous of the Spectator's success with the Izzy Bickerstaff columns, and of Juliet. We had just returned to the hotel from the Brady's Booksmith party for Juliet. We were both tired, and full of ourselves, when up popped Gilly from a chair in the lounge. He begged us to have tea with him. He begged for a short interview with our own wonderful Miss Ashton, or should I say England's very own Izzy Bickerstaff. His smarm alone should have alerted me, but it didn't. I wanted to sit down, gloat over Juliet's success, and have a cream tea. So we did. The talk was going smoothly enough, and my mind was wandering, when I heard Gilly say, "You were a war widow yourself, weren't you? Or rather, almost a war widow, as good as. You were to marry a Lieutenant Rob Dartrey, weren't you? Had made arrangements for the ceremony, hadn't you?" Juliet said, "I beg your pardon, Mr. Gilbert." You know how polite she is. "I don't have it wrong, do I? You and Lieutenant Dartrey did apply for a marriage license. You did make an appointment to be married at the Chelsea Register Office on the 13th of December 1942 at 11 a.m. You did book a table for luncheon at the Ritz, only you never showed up for any of it. It's perfectly obvious that you jilted Lieutenant Dartrey at the altar, poor fellow, and sent him off alone and humiliated back to his ship to carry his broken heart to Burma, where he was killed not 3 months later." I sat up, my mouth gaping open. I just looked on helplessly as Juliet attempted to be civil. "I didn't jilt him at the altar. It was the day before, and he wasn't humiliated. He was relieved. I simply told him that I didn't want to be married after all. Believe me, Mr. Gilbert, He left a happy man, delighted to be rid of me. He didn't slink back to his ship alone and betrayed. He went straight to the CCB club and danced all night with Belinda Twining. Well, Sidney, surprised as Gilly was, he was not daunted. Little rodents like Gilly never are they? He quickly guessed that he was on to an even juicier story for his paper. Oh, ho, he smirked. What was it, then? Drink? Other women? A touch of the old Oscar Wilde? That was when Juliet threw the teapot. You can imagine the hubbub that ensued. The lounge was full of other people having tea, hence, I am sure, the newspapers learning of it. I thought his headline, "Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War Again, Reporter Wounded in Hotel Bunfight," was a bit harsh, but not too bad. But "Juliet's Failed Romeo, A Fallen Hero in Burma," was sick-making, even for Gilly Gilbert and the Hue and Cry. Juliet is worried she may have embarrassed Stevens and Stark, but she is literally sick over Rob Dartry's name being slung around in this fashion. All I could get her to say to me was that Rob Dartry was a good man, a very good man. None of it was his fault, and he did not deserve this. Did you know Rob Dartry? Of course, the drink Oscar Wilde business is pure rot. But why did Juliet call off the wedding? Do you know why? And would you tell me if you did? Of course you wouldn't. I don't know why I'm even asking. The gossip will die down, of course, but does Juliet have to be in London for the thick of it? Should we extend our tour to Scotland? I admit I'm of two minds about this. The sales there have been spectacular, but Juliet has worked so hard at these teas and luncheons. It is not easy to get up in front of a room full of strangers and praise yourself and your book. She's not used to this hoopla like I am, and is, I think, very tired. Sunday will be in Leeds, so let me know then about Scotland. Of course, Gilly Gilbert is despicable and vile, and I hope he comes to a bad end. But he has pushed Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War onto the bestseller list. I'm tempted to write him a thank-you note. Yours in haste, Susan. P.S. Have you found out who Markham V. Reynolds is yet? He sent Juliet a forest of camellias today.
Telegram from Juliet to Sydney. Am terribly sorry to have embarrassed you and Stevens and Stark. Love, Juliet.
From Sydney to Juliet. 26th of January, 1946. Miss Juliet Ashton, The Queen's Hotel, City Square, Leeds. Dear Juliet, don't worry about Gilly. You did not embarrass S&S. I'm only sorry that the tea wasn't hotter and you didn't aim lower. The press is hounding me for a statement regarding Gilly's latest muckraking, and I am going to give them one. Don't worry, it's going to be about journalism in these degenerate times, not about you or Rob Dartry. I just spoke to Susan about going on to Scotland and, though I know Sophie will never forgive me, decided against it. Izzy's sales figures are going up, way up, and I think you should come home. The Times wants you to write a long piece for the supplement, one part of a three-part series they plan to publish in successive issues. I'll let them surprise you with the subject, but I can promise you three things right now. They want it written by Juliet Ashton, not by Izzy Bickerstaff. The subject is a serious one, and the sum mentioned means you can fill your flat with fresh flowers every day for a year. Buy a satin quilt, Lord Woolton says you no longer need to have been bombed out to buy new bed covers, and purchase a pair of real leather shoes, if you can find them. You can have my coupons. The Times doesn't want the article until late spring, so we will have more time to think up a new book possibility for you. All good reasons to hurry back, but the biggest one is that I miss you. Now, about Markham V. Reynolds, Jr. I do know who he is, and the Doomsday book won't help. He's an American. He is the son and heir of Markham V. Reynolds, Sr., who used to have a monopoly on paper mills in the States and now just owns most of them. Reynolds Jr., being of an artistic turn of mind, does not dirty his hands in making paper. He prints on it instead. He's a publisher. The New York Journal, The Word, View, those are all his. And there are several smaller magazines as well. I knew he was in London. Officially, he's here to open the London office of View, but rumour has it that he's decided to begin publishing books, and he's here to beguile England's finest authors with visions of plenty and prosperity in America. I didn't know his technique included roses and camellias, but I'm not surprised. He's always had more than his fair share of what we call cheek, and Americans call can-do spirit. Just wait till you see him. He's been the undoing of stronger women than you, including my secretary. I'm sorry to say she's the one who gave him your itinerary and your address. The silly woman thought he was so romantic-looking with such a lovely suit and handmade shoes.
Dear God!
She couldn't seem to grasp the concept of breach of confidentiality, so I had to sack her. He is after you, Juliet, no doubt about it. Shall I challenge him to a duel? He would undoubtedly kill me, so I'd rather not. My dear, I can't promise you plenty or prosperity or even butter, but you do know that your Stevenson Starks, especially Starks, most beloved author, don't you? Dinner the first evening you are home? Love, Sydney.
From Juliet to Sydney, 28th of January, 1946. Dear Sydney, yes, dinner with pleasure. I'll wear my new dress and eat like a pig. I am so glad I didn't embarrass S&S about Gilly and the teapot. I was worried. Susan suggested I make a dignified statement to the press, too, about Rob Dartry and why we did not marry. I couldn't possibly do that. I honestly don't think I'd mind looking like a fool if it didn't make Rob look a worse one. But it would. And, of course, he wasn't a fool at all. But he'd sound that way. I'd much prefer to say nothing and look like a feckless, flighty, cold-hearted bitch. But I'd like you to know why. I'd have told you before, but you were off with the Navy in 1942, and you never met Rob. Even Sophie never met him. She was up at Bedford that fall, and I swore her to secrecy afterwards. The longer I put off saying anything, the less important it became for you to know, especially in light of how it made me look, witless and foolish for getting engaged in the first place. I thought I was in love. That's the pathetic part, my dear, of being in love. In preparation for sharing my home with a husband, I made room for him so he wouldn't feel like a visiting aunt. I cleared out half my dresser drawers, half my closet, half my medicine chest, half my desk. I gave away my padded hangers and brought in those heavy wooden ones. I took my gollywog off the bed and put her in the attic. Now my flat was meant for two instead of one. On the afternoon before our wedding, Rob was moving in the last of his clothes and belongings while I delivered my Izzy article to the Spectator. When I was through, I tore home, flew up the stairs, and threw open the door to find Rob sitting on a low stool in front of my bookcase, surrounded by cartons. He was sealing the last one up with gummed tape and string. There were eight boxes. Eight boxes of my books bound up and ready for the basement. He looked up and said, "Hello, darling. Don't mind the mess. The porter said he'd help me carry these down to the basement." He nodded toward my bookshelves and said, "Don't they look wonderful?" Well, there were no words. I was too appalled to speak. Sydney, every single shelf where my books had stood was filled with athletic trophies, silver cups, gold cups, blue rosettes, red ribbons. There were awards for every game that could possibly be played with a wooden object. Cricket bats, squash rackets, tennis rackets, oars, golf clubs, ping-pong paddles, bows and arrows, snooker cues, lacrosse sticks, hockey sticks, and polo mallets. There were statues for everything a man could jump over, either by himself or on a horse. Next came the framed certificates, for shooting the most birds on such and such a date, for first place in foot races, for last man standing in some filthy tug of war against Scotland. All I could do was scream, "How dare you? What have you done? Put my books back!" Well, that's how matters started. Eventually, I said something to the effect that I could never marry a man whose idea of bliss was to strike out at little balls and little birds. Rob countered with the remarks about damned blue stockings and shrews, and it all degenerated from there. The only thought we probably had in common was, what the hell have we talked about for the last 4 months? What indeed? He huffed and puffed and snorted and left, and I unpacked my books. Remember the night last year when you met my train to tell me my home had been bombed flat? You thought I was laughing in hysteria. I wasn't. It was in irony. If I'd let Rob store all my books in the basement, I'd still have them. Every one. Sydney, as a token of our long friendship, you do not need to comment on this story. Not ever. In fact, I'd far prefer it if you didn't. Thank you for tracing Markham V. Reynolds, Jr. to his source. So far, his blandishments are entirely floral, and I remain true to you and the Empire. However, I do have a pang of sympathy for your secretary. I hope he sent her some roses for her trouble, as I'm not certain that my scruples could withstand the sight of handmade shoes. If I ever do meet him, I'll take care not to look at his feet, or I'll lash myself to a flagpole first, and then peek, like Odysseus. Bless you for telling me to come home. I'm looking forward to the Times proposal for a series. Do you promise on Sophie's head it will not be a frivolous subject? They aren't going to ask me to write about the Duchess of Windsor, are they? Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sophie Strachan, 31st of January, 1946. Dear Sophie, thank you for your flying visit to Leeds. There are no words to express how much I needed to see a friendly face just then. I honestly was on the verge of stealing away to the Shetlands to take up the life of a hermit. It was beautiful of you to come. The London hue and cry sketch of me taken away in chains was overdrawn. I wasn't even arrested. I know Dominic would much prefer a godmother in prison, but he will have to settle for something less dramatic this time. I told Sydney the only thing I could do about Gilly's callous, lying accusations was to maintain a dignified silence. He said I could do that if I wanted to, but Stevens and Stark could not. He called a press conference to defend the honour of Izzy Bickerstaff, Juliet Ashton, and journalism itself against such trash as Gilly Gilbert. Did it make the papers in Scotland? If not, here are the highlights. He called Gilly Gilbert a twisted weasel. Well, perhaps not in exactly those words, but his meaning was clear. Who lied because he was too lazy to learn the facts and too stupid to understand the damage his lies inflicted upon the noble traditions of journalism. It was lovely. Sophie, could two girls, now women, ever have had a better champion than your brother? I don't think so. He gave a wonderful speech, though I must admit to a few qualms. Gilly Gilbert is such a snake in the grass, I can't believe he'll just slither away without a hiss. Susan said that, on the other hand, Gilly is also such a frightful little coward, he would not dare to retaliate. I hope she's right. Love to you all, Juliet. P.S. That man has sent me another bale of orchids. I'm getting a nervous twitch, waiting for him to come out of hiding and make himself known. Do you suppose this is his strategy?
From Darcy to Juliet, 31st of January 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, your book came yesterday. You are a nice lady, and I thank you with all my heart. I have a job at St. Peter Port Harbour, unloading ships, so I can read during tea breaks. It is a blessing to have real tea and bread with butter, and now, your book. I like it too because the cover is soft, and I can put it in my pocket everywhere I go, though I am careful not to use it up too quickly, and I value having a picture of Charles Lamb. He had a fine head, didn't he? I would like to correspond with you. I will answer your questions as well as I can, though there are many who can tell a story better than I can. I will tell you about our roast pig dinner. I have a cottage and a farm, left to me by my father. Before the war, I kept pigs and grew vegetables for St. Peterport markets and flowers for Covent Garden. I often worked also as a carpenter and roofer. The pigs are gone now. The Germans took them away to feed their soldiers on the continent and ordered me to grow potatoes. We were to grow what they told us and nothing else. At first, before I knew the Germans, as I came to later, I thought I could keep a few pigs hidden for my own self, but the agricultural officer nosed them out and carried them off. Well, that was a blow, but I thought I'd manage all right, for potatoes and turnips were plentiful, and there was still flour then. But it is strange how the mind turns on food. After 6 months of turnips and a lump of gristle now and then, I was hard put to think about anything but a fine full meal. One afternoon, my neighbour, Mrs. Margery, sent me a note. "Come quick," it said, "and bring a butcher knife." I tried not to get my hopes high, but I set out for the manor house at a great clip. And it was true! She had a pig! A hidden pig! And she invited me to join in the feast with her and her friends. I never talked much while I was growing up. I stuttered badly, and I was not used to dinner parties. To tell the truth, Mrs. Margery's was the first one I was ever invited to. I said yes, because I was thinking of the roast pig, but I wished I could take my piece home and eat it there. It was my good luck that my wish didn't come true, because that was the first meeting of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, even though we didn't know it then. The dinner was a rare treat, but the company was better. With talking and eating, we forgot about clocks and curfews until Amelia, that's Mrs. Margery, heard the chimes ring 9 o'clock. We were an hour late. Well, the good food had strengthened our hearts, and when Elizabeth McKenna said we should strike out for our rightful homes instead of skulking in Amelia's house all night, we agreed. But breaking curfew was a crime. I'd heard of folks being sent to prison camp for it, and keeping a pig was a worse one, so we whispered and picked our way through the fields as quiet as could be. We would have come out all right if not for John Booker. He'd drunk more than he'd eaten at dinner, and when we got to the road, he forgot himself and broke into song. I grabbed hold of him, but it was too late. 6 German patrol officers suddenly rose out of the trees with their Lugers drawn and began to shout, "Why were we out after curfew? Where had we been? Where were we going?" I couldn't think what to do. If I ran, they'd shoot me. I knew that much. My mouth was dry as chalk and my mind was blank, so I just held on to Booker and hoped. Then Elizabeth drew in her breath and stepped forward. Elizabeth isn't tall, so those pistols were lined up at her eyes. But she didn't blink. She acted like she didn't see any pistols at all. She walked up to the officer in charge and started talking. "You never heard such lies. How sorry she was that we had broken curfew. How we had been attending a meeting of the Guernsey Literary Society, and the evening's discussion of Elizabeth and her German garden had been so delightful that we had all lost track of time. Such a wonderful book. Had he read it?" None of us had the presence of mind to back her up, but the patrol officer couldn't help himself. He had to smile back at her. "Elizabeth is like that." He took our names and ordered us, very politely, to report to the commandant the next morning. Then he bowed and wished us a good evening. Elizabeth nodded, gracious as could be, while the rest of us edged away, trying not to run like rabbits. Even lugging Booker, I got home quick. That is the story of our roast pig dinner. I'd like to ask you a question of my own. Ships are coming into St. Peterport Harbour every day to bring us things Guernsey still needs. Food, clothes, seed, ploughs, feed for animals, tools, medicine, and most important, now that we have food to eat, shoes. I don't believe that there was a fit pair left on the island by the end of the war. Some of the things being sent to us are wrapped in old newspaper and magazine pages. My friend Clovis and I smooth them out and take them home to read. Then we give them to neighbors who, like us, are eager for any news of the outside world in the past 5 years. Not just any news or pictures. Mrs. Saucy wants to see recipes. Madame LaPelle wants fashion papers. She is a dressmaker. Mr. Bruard reads obituaries. He has his hopes, but won't say who. Claudia Rainey is looking for pictures of Ronald Coleman. Mr. Turtell wants to see beauty queens in bathing dress. And my friend Isola likes to read about weddings. There is so much we wanted to know during the war, but we were not allowed letters or papers from England, or anywhere. In 1942, the Germans called in all the wireless sets. Of course, there were hidden ones, listened to in secret. But if you were caught listening, you could be sent to the camps. That is why we don't understand so many things we can read about now. I enjoy the wartime cartoons, but there is one that bewilders me. It was in a 1944 Punch, and shows 10 or so people walking down a London street. The chief figures are 2 men in bowler hats, holding briefcases and umbrellas, and one man is saying to the other man, "It is ridiculous to say these doodle bugs have affected people in any way." It took me several seconds to realize that every person in the cartoon had one normal-sized ear and one very large ear on the other side of his head. Perhaps you could explain it to me. Yours sincerely, Dorsey Adams.
Juliet to Dorsey, 3rd of February, 1946. Dear Mr. Adams, I am so glad you are enjoying Lamb's letters and the copy of his portrait. He did fit the face I had imagined for him, so I'm glad you felt that way too. Thank you very much for telling me about the roast pig, but don't think I didn't notice that you only answered one of my questions. I'm hankering to know more about the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, and not merely to satisfy my idle curiosity. I now have a professional duty to pry. Did I tell you I am a writer? I wrote a weekly column for The Spectator during the war, and Stevens and Stark Publishers collected them together into a single volume and published them under the title Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War. Izzy was the nom de plume The Spectator chose for me, and now, thank heavens, the poor thing has been laid to rest, and I can write under my own name again. I would like to write a book, but I am having trouble thinking of a subject I could live happily with for several years. In the meantime, The Times has asked me to write an article for the Literary Supplement. They want to address the practical, moral, and philosophical value of reading, spread out over 3 issues and by 3 different authors. I am to cover the philosophical side of the debate, and so far my only thought is that reading keeps you from going gaga. You can see I need help. Do you think your literary society would mind being included in such an article? I know that the story of the society's founding would fascinate the Times' readers, and I'd love to learn more about your meetings. But if you'd rather not, please don't worry. I will understand either way, and either way would like to hear from you again. I remember the Punch cartoon you described very well, and think it was the word doodlebug that threw you off. That was the name coined by the Ministry of Information. It was meant to sound less terrifying than Hitler's V-1 rockets or pilotless bombs. We were all used to bombing raids at night and the sights that followed, but these were unlike any bombs we had seen before. They came in the daytime, and they came so fast there was no time for an air raid siren or to take cover. You could see them. They looked like slim, black, slanted pencils and made a dull, spastic sound above you, like a motor car running out of petrol. As long as you could hear them coughing and putt-putting, you were safe. You could think, "Thank God, it's going past me." But when their noise stopped, it meant there was only 30 seconds before it plummeted. So you listened for them, listened hard for the sound of their motors cutting out. I did see a doodlebug fall once. I was quite some distance away when it hit, so I threw myself down in the gutter and cuddled up against the curb. Some women in the top story of a tall office building down the street had gone to an open window to watch. They were sucked out by the force of the blast. It seems impossible now that someone could have drawn a cartoon about doodlebugs, and that everyone, including me, could have laughed at it. But we did. The old adage, humour is the best way to make the unbearable bearable, may be true. Has Mr. Hastings found the Lucas biography for you yet? Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton. From Juliet to Markham Reynolds. 4th of February, 1946. Mr. Markham Reynolds, 63 Halkin Street, London, SW1. Dear Mr. Reynolds, I captured your delivery boy in the act of depositing a clutch of pink carnations upon my doorstep. I seized him and threatened him until he confessed your address. You see, Mr. Reynolds, you are not the only one who can inveigle innocent employees. I hope you don't sack him. He seems a nice boy, and he really had no alternative. I menaced him with remembrance of things past. Now I can thank you for the dozens of flowers you've sent me. It's been years since I've seen such roses, such camellias, such orchids, and you have no idea how they lift my heart in this shivering winter. Why I deserve to live in a bower, when everyone else has to be satisfied with bedraggled leafless trees and slush, I don't know, but I'm perfectly delighted to do so. Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton.
From Markham Reynolds to Juliet. February 5th, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I didn't fire the delivery boy. I promoted him. He got me what I couldn't manage to get for myself. An introduction to you. The way I see it, your note is a figurative handshake, and the preliminaries are now over. I hope you're of the same opinion, as it will save me the trouble of wangling an invitation to Lady Bascom's next dinner party on the off chance you might be there. Your friends are a suspicious lot, especially that fellow Stark, who said it wasn't his job to reverse the direction of the Lend-Lease and refused to bring you to the cocktail party I threw at the View office. God knows my intentions are pure, or at least non-mercenary. The simple truth of it is that you're the only female writer who makes me laugh. Your Izzy Bickerstaff columns were the wittiest work to come out of the war, and I want to meet the woman who wrote them. If I swear that I won't kidnap you, will you do me the honor of dining with me next week? You pick the evening. I'm entirely at your disposal. Yours, Markham Reynolds.
From Juliet to Markham Reynolds, 6th of February, 1946. Dear Mr. Reynolds, I am no proof against compliments, especially compliments about my writing. I'll be delighted to dine with you. Thursday next? Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton.
From Markham Reynolds to Juliet, February 7th, 1946. Dear Juliet, Thursday's too far away. Monday, Claridge's, 7 o'clock. Yours, Mark. P.S. I don't suppose you have a telephone, do you?
From Juliet to Markham, 7th of February, 1946. Dear Mr. Reynolds, all right. Monday, Claridge's, 7. I do have a telephone. It's in Oakley Street, under a pile of rubble that used to be my flat. I'm only subletting here, and my landlady, Mrs. Olive Burns, possesses the sole telephone on the premises. If you would like to chat with her, I can give you her number. Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton.
From Dawsey to Juliet, 7th of February, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I'm certain the Guernsey Literary Society would like to be included in your article for the Times. I have asked Mrs. Margery to write to you about our meetings, as she is an educated lady and her words will sound more at home in an article than mine could. I don't think we are much like literary societies in London. Mr. Hastings hasn't found a copy of the Lucas biography yet, but I had a postcard from him saying, "Hard on the trail, don't give up." He is a kind man, isn't he? I'm hauling slates for the Crown Hotel's new roof. The owners are hoping that tourists may want to come back this summer. I am glad of the